talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, how the Oxford English Dictionary was crowdsourced from a surprising and diverse group of people, from astronomers to murderers, pornographers to suffragists. We'll also explore one of the bloodiest periods in English history, known as the Anarchy, and find out how women were prime movers in this time of conflict and lawlessness. We'll discuss two centuries of British medieval history, a time of civil war, the murder of kings, a devastating national pandemic, and the first major peasant uprising in English history. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. Last week, our show marked the 50th anniversary of ABBA winning the Eurovision with the song Waterloo, and we talked about how it helped propel them to global superstardom. And if you want to listen back to this or to any of our older shows, just go to the News Talk app powered by Go Loud, our website newstalk.com, or wherever you download your podcasts. We begin tonight's show with the dictionary people. What do three murderers, Karl Marx's daughter, and a vegetarian vicar have in common? They all helped create the Oxford English Dictionary, and a new book takes a deep dive into previously untapped archives to tell a people's history of the OED. The book is called The Dictionary People, The Unsung Heroes Who Created the Oxford English Dictionary. It's published in hardback by Chatto & Windus. The author is Dr. Sarah Ogilvy. And Sarah, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you, Patrick. It's great to be with you.
Well, I have to then start with that hook. What do three murderers, Karl Marx's daughter and a vegetarian, have to do with the Oxford English Dictionary, and how are they all connected?
Well, they are part of this large group of people who responded to a call from Oxford. When they were creating the dictionary, they knew that they wanted to create for the first time the largest English dictionary ever written, but they knew that a small group of men in Oxford or London couldn't do that alone. So they crowdsourced it and they asked people all around the world to read their local books, write out words and quotations from those books, and to send them into Oxford on little slips of 4x6-inch paper. And we never knew exactly who all those people were, but we knew that they were vital because without their contribution, the dictionary could never have been written. So about 10 years ago now, I was down in the basement of Oxford University Press, which is in Oxford, where all of these slips are still kept. There are now 4 million slips stored down there in boxes. And I was looking through some of the boxes, and I took the lid off one particular dusty box. And inside, I found this little black book tied with cream ribbon. And when I opened it up, I immediately recognized the immaculate handwriting of James Murray, who was the longest serving editor of the dictionary. And this little book turned out to be his address book with the names and addresses of all of those people, many of them living in Ireland, but stretching down to Australia, to New Zealand, to Canada, to South Africa, and not just within the Commonwealth, but people outside of the British Empire as well, people in Japan and South America. So this truly was a global crowdsourced project, sort of the Wikipedia of the 19th century. And part of those people were, as you said, really colorful characters, from murderers to there is a cannibal, there are gay couples. It's a complete mix of people.
So talk to us about one of those murderers who was in Broadmoor Prison, but he sent in over 60,000 words.
He did, yes. And some of your listeners probably know about him because a wonderful book was written about him, Dr. Minor. A book was written about him about 25 years ago. And he was, and that book was by Simon Winchester called The Professor and the Madman. And so he was this American surgeon who came over to London, was in a brothel in London, and someone he thought ran off with his wallet. So he ran into the streets of Lambeth and took out his pistol and fired and shot this man who he thought had stolen his wallet, but he got the completely wrong person, and he killed an innocent man and ended up in Broadmoor, where they were very lenient, and they let him bring to the prison his wonderful collection of 17th century medical texts. So every morning he would wake up in one cell and walk into the cell next door and spend the entire day reading those books and sending in slips to Dr. Murray. But with this address book, we now know that he was just one of three murderers. And in fact, he was not the person who sent in the most slips. That credit belongs to someone called Thomas Austin, who sent in 165,000 slips. So these people were totally devoted and dedicated. And this is really a story of devotion and generosity, because they did this for free. They were volunteering. And so, yeah, it's a real testament. And this is kind of the first time that we've known who all those people were. So in writing this book, I was really wanting to shine a light on them finally and give them credit for their wonderful work.
When you're getting all of these slips being sent in, all of these different words and all of that, how did the editors actually know that these were accurate and correct, and that there weren't errors or pranksters or other kinds of problems with them?
That's a fantastic question. And what they did is, when they first received slips from people, they would check the accuracy, and they would go to the Bodleian Library and look up that particular book and check whether, in fact, this person was sending in the correct quotations. And then they just took it on trust. And I mean, not everyone was reliable. So when you read through Dr. Murray's address book, he's got these fantastic notes where, you know, some people beside their names, he wrote hopeless or no good or threw up, gave up or stole the book. So there are these really cute comments throughout the address books, which give us glimpses into these characters. And in fact, one of the chapters is H for hopeless contributors. So I devote a whole chapter to that, because in fact, Karl Marx's daughter, Eleanor, was one of those hopeless contributors. But I will leave that for the listeners to read about themselves. It's a fun story.
And as you've mentioned, there were Irish contributors as well. And one of the most fascinating was a woman in Sligo called Edith Phibbs.
Oh, she is one of my favorites, because she and her brother Owen lived, as you say, in County Sligo, in a beautiful house there called Seafield, and they collected mummies. Well, Owen was an amateur archaeologist who used to travel through Egypt and the Middle East with Edith, and Edith then collected mummies, and they decided, rather than to hide them away in cupboards or to give them to a museum, they decided to turn one of the floors of their house into a mummy exhibit. And so when you went to visit them, you'd be sitting there drinking tea surrounded by these mummies. And their house then, towards the end of the 19th century, got a bit of a reputation for being haunted. So in fact, in the early 20th century, they changed the name of the house, but it seems that it then just fell into disrepair. And in fact, a friend of mine, a colleague at Campion Hall at Oxford, which is my college there, he is from County Sligo, and he took a photo of the house for me last summer. And it is like a completely wrecked house, you know, covered in vines and things. So yes, that was Edith Phibbs and her brother Owen, and they read books to do with geography and archaeology and sent in thousands of words to the dictionary from those fields.
And as you say, you know, all kinds of people sending in these slips. And you also had a craze for simplifying some of the spellings.
Yeah, so in the late 19th century, there was this fad to try and change English spelling because people realized that English, as we all know, is famous for spelling in ways that are different from how the words are pronounced. And so it is very difficult for learners of English, and it's a very difficult language for people to learn to read for the first time. So there was this fad to start up different spelling orthographic systems, and many of the people who contributed to the dictionary believed in those systems and used to write letters to each other in these strange spellings. And so that, when I was doing the research for the book, I found several letters from James Murray to, in fact, one of the key contributors, someone called Alexander John Ellis. And it was in this simplified spelling called glossotype, which Alexander John Ellis had invented. So that was fascinating to see that the editor of the dictionary even believed in changing the spelling of the English language.
And they even had to construct an extra big postbox, mailbox in Oxford to cope with all of the correspondence that was coming in.
That's right. I mean, when they first put this call out around the world, they had no idea whether this would be a success or not. But in fact, so many people sent in slips, so many people from all around the world, that Royal Mail had to put a red pillar box right outside Murray's house at 78 Banbury Road, Oxford. And if you walk past the house today, that red pillar box is still there.
You know, I was fascinated by your comparison with Wikipedia, because when Wikipedia started, there was a real snobbery against it. And I think as time has passed, its value and its worth has become more apparent. But, you know, was there ever that kind of snobbery when it came to the OED?
That's a fabulous question. And I think not, because so they didn't wait until the dictionary. So the dictionary took 70 years to finish. And so they started it in 1858 and it finally finished in 1928. Rather than waiting until 1928 to publish the whole 12 volumes, then what they did is they started to publish it in the 1880s in little chunks of the alphabet. And so ultimately, between 1884 and 1928, there ended up being about 125 different what are called fascicles, little chunks. And in the preface to each of these fascicles, Murray wrote thanks to some of the contributors. So we knew that there were several hundred, but what these address books showed us is that there were actually 3,000 people who sent in slips. So, but what's interesting is to look at who Murray actually thanked. And I did a comparison of that, and he actually thanked mainly the famous people, the scholars, but they were actually the people in the minority. So when you look across the whole 3,000 people, most of them are not the scholarly elites. They are the amateurs. They're the autodidacts. They're the people who actually left school at about the age of 14 or 15, which actually is the same as Murray himself. He left school at 14. And then he taught himself 25 languages by reading different versions of the Gospels, which had been written by missionaries. So there wasn't this snobbery against the dictionary, because people didn't actually know the extent of who was actually helping, and the fact that this really was a project of the masses rather than the elites.
Do you have a favourite contributor?
I do, and that person stars in, so the book has 26 short chapters, because I wanted to write it so that people could just read a little chapter before going to bed. So it goes from A to Z, as you might expect. And in the chapter L for Lunatics, it's all about how the top four contributors all spent time in psychiatric hospitals, which at the time were called lunatic asylums. And one of my favorite characters there is a man called John Dormer. And I'll leave it for the reader to discover about him. But it's a really sad story, but a very poignant and beautiful one.
Okay, well, my thanks to Sarah Ogilvy for joining me tonight to talk about her new book. It's called The Dictionary People, The Unsung Heroes Who Created the Oxford English Dictionary. It's published in hardback by Chatto and Windus, a superb read. And Sarah, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Patrick. It's been an absolute pleasure.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back to Talking History. Between 1199 and 1399, English politics was high drama. These two centuries witnessed savage political bloodletting, including civil war, the murder of kings and the ruthless execution of rebel lords, as well as international warfare, a devastating national pandemic, economic crisis, and the first major peasant uprising in English history. And a new book explores England's emerging statehood in this period. The book is called Arise England, Six Kings and the Making of the English State. It's published in hardback by Faber and Faber. The authors are Caroline Burt and Richard Partington. And Caroline and Richard, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be with you.
So, Caroline, I might start with you and this whole idea of telling the history of the English state over this 200-year period and doing it through these six very interesting kings, one John, three Henrys, an Edward and a Richard.
Yeah, so it came to our minds because we've been teaching this period and working on this period for a long time. And the sense in which both individual agency, you know, just what people drove themselves and the circumstances they were in could in themselves together create massive state change was something that we wanted to convey to people.
And Richard, who do you think was the worst king from this period?
Oh, that's a really good question, Patrick. So you've got three candidates, John, Edward II and Richard II. And I personally would go for Edward II because he was just so irresponsible and incompetent. In the case of John, he was a really dangerous, cruel man, but he was also a man of ability. And in the case of Richard II, there was a sort of political intelligence there. And although in many ways he was like Edward II, he didn't quite have Edward II's total haplessness and kind of spiteful cruelty. But maybe it's close between Edward II and Richard II, but I would go with Edward.
And Richard, it really is a period when you see the whole idea of monarchy evolving and changing.
It is. And I think one of the things that's really interesting, Patrick, is the extent to which the king goes from being a really powerful private individual who happens to be head of state at the start of this period, 1199, through by the mid-14th century to be somebody who is very much a public figure. And in a way, the whole purpose and identity and objectives of government start to be swept into a public space during these 200 years. So when King John, for example, is appealing for support from his subjects in fighting his wars in France in the late 12th and early 13th centuries, he's essentially doing it as a private individual. By the time you get to the Hundred Years' War and Edward III, it's a public enterprise. This is the realm's war. It's England's war and Wales's war and the War of Aquitaine. It's no longer the king's war that he seeks help with from his people.
And Caroline, it's a brilliant read because I hadn't realised that there were quite so many nobles being murdered throughout these centuries, that there were kings being deposed, there were kings being murdered, that it really wasn't a particularly safe time to be a noble, it seemed.
It wasn't a very safe time after King John's reign to be a noble who was a problematic personality, let's put it that way. I mean, it's funny, it strikes me that we talk about this period as being, in certain respects, quite politically stable, in the sense that people weren't kind of just randomly attacking each other. But as you've just pointed out, it is pretty unstable from the point of view of, you know, the jeopardy if you're a poor king or if you're a noble who gets yourself into trouble. We're talking about King John, for example, simply because he might wake up one morning and decide he doesn't trust you anymore. There's not much you can do about that. Or in the other reigns, if you're somebody who has caused particular problems, like Thomas of Lancaster, you can find yourself in really serious trouble to the extent of losing your life relatively quickly, certainly compared to now anyway.
Patrick, I think it's a really important point to make about the role of the individual, which Caroline talked about earlier. in this period, there's a 50-year reign, the reign of Edward III, in which, apart from right at the very beginning when he removes the tyrant Roger Mortimer, who's hanged for treason, not a single nobleman is killed. There are some people who die on campaign or die in battle in foreign wars, but there's a 50-year period in which it's really safe to be a nobleman because you've got a king on the throne who's really focused upon the common good and who's really good at his job. So in other words, it's political chaos that creates danger. And when there was political chaos, yes, it was very dangerous.
But Richard, even there, I was fascinated by the character of Mortimer because it seemed that it was a very unsafe thing to do, to depose a monarch, because people seemed to take it out on you afterwards, and it didn't seem to be good for your long-term survival if you were involved in something like that.
I think that's it's perfectly understandable that you think that, Patrick, but I think if you look at Mortimer, the reason why Mortimer was removed was not because he was part of the deposition of Edward II, because many people, the entire political community, was part of the deposition of Edward II. It's what he did afterwards. It's the fact that he became a tyrant, that he essentially sought to take control of the realm for himself, and that he stripped the realm, that he plundered other people, seized their lands and seized their money. And it's that in particular that led to his own arrest and execution, rather than the fact that he had participated in the deposition. I mean, he certainly was instrumental in the death of Edward II when Edward II was murdered in captivity. But it's difficult, I think, to get away from that. But most of the time when people are targeted, they're targeted not because they've taken a position of political principle, but because they're seen to be a really selfish and merciless and cruel individual.
And Caroline, with a book entitled Arise England that goes up to 1399, I had expected that by the time we arrived at 1399, things were going to be in a very good state. But instead, we have the government collapsing, we have nobles being murdered once again, we have Richard II being deposed and possibly murdered. That now, you do have Bolingbroke succeeding him, but it still seemed to be a very chaotic period at the end of the book.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when we talk about Arise England, one of the big things that we're focusing on there is the fact that the English state had developed so substantially in that 200-year period. I mean, it was not, obviously not the only period in which the English state develops, but it's a very important period for that. So understanding that development was what we wanted to get across. But at the same time, yes, absolutely, just as now, you can have complete political chaos within a actually relatively well-developed state system. And you know, in certain respects, that state system protects us all from what might be happening with individuals and wider circumstances, but it can't do that completely, either now or in 1399. We're still very much at the mercy of individuals, as Richard II's reign shows, in fact.
And it definitely shows how the medieval world has helped shape our own.
Absolutely. So if you look at things that we take for granted now, so the parliament that we have in Great Britain, the legal system based on the common law, those are things which developed substantially in this period. The sense of a king or a government that has to obey the same law as all of the rest of us, again, that originates properly in this period. So it's formative from the point of view of establishing many of the kind of pillars on which the democracy that we now have stands, despite being a democracy rather than a monarchy in the conventional sense of monarchy.
And when you look at the development of the legal system and the development of parliament and even something like taxation, is the common good at the heart of all of that?
So it can be, and in a very positive way, and it can be in a negative way, in the sense that you've got, if you've got kings who really understand what the duty of a government is, then the sorts of things that they will do will be relating to the common good, to upholding the common good. So they'll be trying to maintain order, to make sure somebody doesn't just come and steal all your stuff or, you know, murder your brother. You know, these are fundamentals that you would hope the king was doing for the common good. So it can be a very positive thing, and the impetus can come from the king. It can come from his subjects in a very positive way, in that they want more access to the law, for example. There doesn't have to be a crisis, they just want more of it. I mean, there's actually somebody in Edward I's reign who rocks up to court with a writ of conspiracy, and the judge says to him, well, this has got nothing to do with conspiracy. And the guy goes, yeah, but it's the new writ. So you know, there's that hunger for this government that will help people. But it's also it also emerges out of crisis. You know, one of the reasons why the rebels under Henry III talk so much about the common good is because they've kind of got it from the ideas that are all around them and to some extent from the king himself. And they're saying, right, well, OK, you're not actually protecting the common good, so we have to force you to do that. Either way, it all kind of comes back to the common good, whether it be in a positive set of circumstances or a negative set of circumstances.
And Richard, politicians always like to say, oh, well, we would have made great progress only for, you know, these external circumstances, things beyond our control, international conflicts and so on. But you definitely see that during this 200-year period, because there are international conflicts. There is a devastating pandemic where something like 30 to 50% of the population in Britain perishes. You have all of these things, a peasant uprising, that there are all of these challenges that really impede all of the progress that's also taking place.
They do impede progress, but they also impel progress. And I think it's really important to recognise that if you have government, Patrick, that is very strongly focused upon shared endeavour, on the common good, upon doing the right thing for everyone, then in the face of crisis, it will tend to find solutions. Now, that's not to say that circumstances can't be really challenging, because there are times when circumstances make it almost impossible to make political progress. But if you take the Black Death, you're absolutely right. Say, for the sake of argument, that 40% of the population of England perished in the space of about a year. It's extraordinary that the government was able to maintain, with the agreement of Parliament, taxation throughout that time. It was able to maintain defence and foreign policy intact. It was able to continue with its really important legal reforms. And in fact, those legal reforms then expand to encompass dealing with the consequences of the Black Death. So government keeps going in the face of crisis, but it keeps going in the face of crisis because it's very, very strongly focused upon the common good. And I think one of the lessons for modern politicians would be that actually, devotion to duty, a proper sense of governmental responsibility, and authenticity and openness, collaboration, these are all ways to deal with really serious political problems. But of course, party politics can make that challenging. And it's, of course, also difficult in a social media age, perhaps to take that, you know, the bipartisan collaborative line in the long term, which is what actually most people need from government.
And Caroline, it is called Arise England. It's not called Arise Britain, because there are all of these conflicts and tensions. So you have England conquering Wales, you have conflict with Scotland, you then have this wider conflict with France, so that this is a time of warfare, this is a time of conflict and crisis.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you know, if we think about Great Britain today, it really came about in significant part through accident, you know, accident of birth in the 17th century, for example. So, you know, and it's easy to look back now and think that we were always as we are. But of course, it simply wasn't the case. And England was for a long time both aspiring to be and at times actually managed to be the dominant nation within the British Isles. And that caused real clashes with other nations, not least where, you know, you've got somewhere like Scotland, which is a realm in and of itself and does not recognise the idea that somehow the English are overlords, the English kings are overlords of the Scottish kings. And in Wales, you've got power dynamics internally in which people, various princely families within Wales are attempting to cement their own authority within the territory, but they are vassals of the English king. And so then you've got problems with how they relate and interact with the English king. And if they behave in a way that the English king isn't happy with, as they do under Edward I, then you end up with warfare and ultimately actually conquest. So the whole thing is a kind of melting pot for crisis geopolitically, as well as in other ways within England.
One thing I would really want to emphasise, Patrick, is the extent to which certainly where England, Scotland, and to a very significant degree Wales are concerned, and maybe even to a degree Ireland, you've got a single European political elite who are operating in different realms. The most important Scottish politicians all have very extensive lands in England and vice versa. So much politics of England, in inverted commas, in the Middle Ages actually happens in Wales. And that's because so many great English lords had really substantive Welsh holdings. And it's really interesting to me that there's so much assimilation across political boundaries in different jurisdictions, but at the same time, national identity remains very strong. And that's one of the things that makes it so complex and so interesting, that when the English are fighting the Scots, for example, a lot of the time, the English are fighting a mix of Scottish and Irish focused lords, and the, in inverted commas, Scots are a mix of kind of Scotsmen and Anglo-Scotsmen. It's very, very complex. Although nationality emerges, perhaps definitively in the 14th century, it remains surprisingly fluid.
And Richard, it's also fascinating just to see how much the personality and character of the monarch helps shape the regime and the reign. Because Edward I, you show how he had energy, determination, ability. Edward II was negligent and lazy. And then Edward III had just this completely dysfunctional childhood where his father and uncle were murdered and he was kept a prisoner by his mother's lover. And that, of course, shaped his early development then as well. And so much seemed to be tied up with the personality of the king.
I think one of the extraordinary things about Edward III, who in many ways was, you know, almost the complete political leader, so effective, was that he had this amazingly dysfunctional childhood. And I think often we look at politicians or actors of, you know, within whatever setting, and we say, ah, well, look, it's all rooted in a terrible childhood. Edward III's childhood was appalling, and yet he seems to have come out completely well-adjusted. An extraordinary thing. But yes, how much of a difference can individuals make? Well, if the individual is the political leader, which the king was, they can make an enormous difference. And one of the things about Edward II that was so problematic was simply the fact that he was enormously lazy, that he never really spent any time on government business. I mean, in the same way that, you know, one of the great problems for Nazi Germany in terms of its effectiveness as a state was that Adolf Hitler was in bed until 2 o'clock in the afternoon every day. And I think many people would point to some of the recent dysfunction in the government in the UK and say that that was about key politicians not being focused enough on the job. So the individual can make a huge difference.
Caroline, there seems to be wonderful records for this period as well that allows the story to be told so brilliantly and so vividly.
Yeah, you would assume there wasn't much around from, you know, 800 years ago to be able to do this, but there is. Although the chronicle tradition for most of the period that we're writing about was not as strong as it had been, we've got quite a lot of fantastic legal documents with great detail in them, telling us what was going on, what people were arguing about. And sometimes that's actually really boring, but actually quite a lot of the time it gives you these amazing nuggets of information. And although I said the chronicle tradition wasn't as great as it had been, what we do have is tremendously helpful, particularly under Edward II. You've got this wonderful life of Edward II that unfortunately doesn't take us right to the end of the reign, but is a fantastic commentary on politics and political actors, written, you know, very at some level very informally, although within a kind of formal chronicle context. You know, so when the nobles change sides at one point, which they may actually have done for very good reasons, the chronicler is great. He just kind of goes, well, they're always doing this, aren't they? I mean, you know, see how often and abruptly the great men change their sides. And you think it's really interesting to see their take on it. Whereas when we step back and look at a wider array of facts, we can see something slightly different. But that gives you that personal insight. And you get the same with Richard II. I mean, Richard II, you've got some wonderfully detailed chronicle sources that tell us about what on earth is going on in politics and the absolute mess of brutality that it became. So we were very, very lucky in having both, you know, formal governmental sources that are very different and more extensive, much more extensive than most countries of this period. And, you know, these chronicles that give us such exciting nuggets of information and opinion.
Well, it's a fascinating story. The book is called Arise, England, Six Kings and the Making of the English State. It's published in hardback by Faber and Faber. The authors are Caroline Burt and Richard Partington. And Caroline, Richard, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's been a very great pleasure. Thank you, Patrick.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back to Talking History. In the year 1135, Stephen of Blois usurped the throne, stealing it from his cousin Empress Matilda and sparking a 19-year civil war that would become known as the Anarchy, one of the bloodiest periods in English history. On the one side is Empress Matilda, on the other, her cousin Queen Matilda, supporting her husband Stephen and fighting to see her own son inherit the English crown. And the story is told brilliantly in a new book, Women of the Anarchy. It's published in hardback by Amberley Publishing. The author is Sharon Bennett Connolly, and I'm delighted to welcome her to the show tonight. Sharon, you're very welcome.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
It's a remarkable story, and it's, I have to admit, one that I'd never heard of before. Even the name, The Anarchy, it's a brilliant title for what is a remarkably bloody period.
It is. It's a fabulous title, although, as I keep telling people, it's really weird because most of the time when you see mention of the Anarchy, it's mentioned as the period known as the Anarchy rather than just it's the Anarchy. So it's really odd that sometimes that it doesn't really have its full name, and it's often lost in the fact that it comes after the conquest and before the rise of the Plantagenets. So it's sort of one of those more overlooked periods in history.
Now, I don't think it would work as a TV program. Or, well, it would if you change the names, because it's very confusing to have the two main characters here both called Matilda.
Yeah, I think it was the Victorians who changed the Empress's name to Maud to make it easier for people. But I've stuck with the fact that Empress Matilda was Empress Matilda, and that was the name she would have answered to and the name she was known at the time. So in the book, you'll always see it as Queen Matilda and Empress Matilda to distinguish between the two of them. But yeah, there were a lot of Matildas in the 12th century.
And it's fascinating that even though these women weren't able to wield a sword, they played a pivotal role and they were driving what was happening in this period of conflict.
They were, both of them as well. I think Empress Matilda is often criticised as being haughty, and she's come down through history as being, you know, too haughty to be queen and not regal enough, because she knew who she was and she knew that she could be queen and she could rule. And then you have Matilda of Boulogne, Stephen's wife, who gets so overlooked, and yet she played such a pivotal role in the war. If it wasn't for her, Stephen wouldn't have even had the money to claim the crown, because he did it through her county of Boulogne. If it wasn't for her, the Treaty of Durham of 1139 wouldn't have happened. And neither would, when Stephen was captured in 1141, it was because Matilda of Boulogne carried on the war that he was released by the end of the year and back on the throne.
So tell me about Empress Matilda. She was the first woman to claim the throne of England in her own right, but it seems that there was prejudice against her from the very beginning.
Yes, there was, unfortunately. It's she was born to rule. She was, when she was 8 years old, she was sent to Germany to become the wife of the Holy Roman Emperor Henry V, and she was trained to rule, and she acted as regent while she was empress in Germany. But her husband died in 1125 and they had no children, so she was recalled to England, because Henry I had lost his only legitimate son in 1120 in the White Ship disaster. So he recognised Matilda as his heir, and he had all the barons in 1126 swear to support her claim to the throne, including Stephen of Blois, by the way. He swore twice that he would support Matilda's claim to the throne. But when it came to it in 1135, he, and to be fair, most of the barons, all except one, decided that she shouldn't rule and that he should be king instead. But then in 1138, after Matilda had given birth to her third son and was able to launch her own campaign, she came to England to try and claim the throne. And 1141, after Stephen was captured, she was actually named Lady of the English and effective ruler of England. Unfortunately, thanks to Matilda of Boulogne's persistence, it didn't last. But yeah, she was named Lady of the English, so she was named as ruler of England in 1141.
And it's fascinating the way they were able to keep things going despite all of the turmoil and chaos and conflict and, you know, husbands being captured and so on, that they were really able to you know, continue the struggle and fight it on the terms they wanted.
Yes, it is. And it's amazing the way the women actually led the struggle. 1141 is actually known as the War of the Two Matildas. That's the name for that year, because it was the first and I believe only time that women were at the head of both opposing armies, you know, in English history. I haven't found another instance of that. So it just shows how they both believed in their rights and that they were right. But yeah, even though there was war in England for 19 years, they still ruled. You know, there was still, commerce was still going on, marriages were still happening, and families were getting on with their lives in and around the armies marching up and down the country.
So talk to me then about the strengths and weaknesses of the two Matildas, because they each had certain qualities that aided them in their leadership, but they also had certain elements that undermined them.
Yeah, I think they both had very similar qualities, but it was their focus and their aims that were different. In the beginning of the war, from 1135 to 1142, Empress Matilda was trying to claim the throne for herself in her own right, whereas Queen Matilda of Boulogne was trying to preserve the throne for her husband and then her son, Eustace of Boulogne. So it was the Empress Matilda wanted it for herself, whereas Queen Matilda wanted it for her son. And men in those days wanted their sons to inherit. They didn't want their daughters to inherit. So they would look more favourably on Queen Matilda because she was acting like a woman was expected to act, supporting her husband, supporting her sons, and not doing anything for herself. Whereas Empress Matilda, because it was her right to the throne that she was trying to claim, it was like she was doing it for herself. So she was seen as haughty and arrogant. And there's this incident where her uncle, King David of Scots, and her brother, Robert Earl of Gloucester, walk into a room and she doesn't stand. And she's criticised for this, even though she is socially superior to them, because she is a woman. She's expected to stand, whereas she thought, no, I'm queen, so I'm not expected to stand.
Who wins in the end? Because there is a truce and an agreement, and it seems perhaps you could say perhaps both sides win in that Stephen continues on as king, but it is actually the Empress Matilda's son Henry who is named as heir and who then becomes King Henry II.
Yeah, I think the thing is, after 1142, the focus, Empress Matilda's, I think she probably learns a little bit from her cousin Matilda of Boulogne, and she realises that the English barons are never going to accept her as queen. Her son, Henry of Anjou, he actually calls himself Henry Fitz-Empress, to distinguish the fact that he is Matilda's daughter. He's brought over to England at the age of 14 and the focus gradually changes to Henry is the grandson of Henry I and he is the rightful king. You know, if the inheritance went down, it should be Henry who gets the throne. So the focus is changed to make it so that Henry is the one going for the throne instead of Empress Matilda, which is much more acceptable to the barons. And Stephen, he's trying to get the throne to secure the succession for his son. And he even appeals to the Pope to have his son Eustace crowned in his lifetime to guarantee Eustace's succession. But the Pope says no. And then Eustace dies unexpectedly in 1153. And that leaves the way open for Stephen to make an agreement with Henry that Stephen keeps the throne for the rest of his life, but he adopts Henry as his son and Henry will rule after Stephen. Yes, Stephen gets to keep the throne, but in the end, Empress Matilda wins because it's her son who gets onto the throne in 1154 and founds the Plantagenet dynasty, which will then rule England until 1485.
Yeah, as you mentioned, you know, Stephen gets it for the rest of his life. But as you say there, he dies 1154. So it's only a year after the agreement. So it really isn't any length of time at all.
No, and also, and Stephen does have another son, William, his younger son, who is only a year or two younger than Henry. But William, as Steve, I think Stephen realises that the barons, when presented with William, the son of Stephen the usurper, or Henry, the rightful heir to the throne, Stephen realises nobody's going to support William's claim against Henry, because Henry by this point is already Duke of Normandy and Count of Anjou, and has got a rather substantial following. He's already been knighted by his uncle. He is the epitome of chivalry. And Stephen realises nobody's going to support William. So he gives William this financial settlement, a very rich heiress, so that he's comfortable. But he accepts that Henry is the one who has the support of the barons and will be King of England after him.
What do you think would have happened if Stephen hadn't died in 1154? Do you think there would have been plots to murder Henry so that the succession would be reopened then?
Well, there was a plot sometime in late 1153 by Stephen's younger son, William, where they intended to ambush Henry and probably kill him. He hired some Flemings to do it, but William fell off his horse and broke his leg during the expedition. So it didn't happen. And Henry wisely took ship to Normandy to sit there and wait out Stephen's death. So, yes, I think it's likely that there would have been more plots to kill Henry. But in the end, Henry was quite an accomplished soldier by this point. So I don't think he felt too much in danger. But I do think that if Stephen had lasted too long, much too longer, then there might have been plots against Stephen as well.
Very interesting. And you really get an insight during this period about just how difficult life was for women, because there was challenges to do with marriage, there's challenges to do with how they dealt with their children, that there was a lot of difficult things they had to negotiate.
There was, and they had to do it very subtly, because nobody in those days liked an outspoken woman or a woman who knew her own mind. She was supposed to be humble and subservient to her husband. So women had to find wily ways of getting their desires across and getting things their own way. And I think Matilda of Boulogne in particular is a prime example of a woman who knew how to manipulate things to get what she wanted.
And what do you think we learn when we look at this period of the anarchy? What lessons do you think we can take from it?
I think we have to look at it, and we have to look at the way we've viewed history over the last few centuries and change it around and actually look at the fact that women have played a role in history throughout, and a very significant role that is often ignored because they didn't fight wars. Because they didn't wield a sword. But Empress Matilda and Queen Matilda both demonstrate how women could use power and how they influenced events without wielding a sword.
Well, it's a fascinating story. It's called Women of the Anarchy. It's published in hardback by Amberley Publishing. The author, Sharon Bennett Connolly. And Sharon, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Patrick. It's been a real pleasure.
And that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marisa Sullivan, to Steve Daunt and Hannah Flam on research, and to Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.